Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Robert O'Hearn, and we are across from Sam Twyford Moore, who is coming to talk about ways of looking at Mania, the Rapids. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This is a timely book because I don't know whether it's the era we're in, the nature of the era we're in, the obsessive nature of having smartphones, the Trump era, the anxiety that all this stuff creates. But there is so much more open and honest discussion around mental health issues and mental health. Are they combined, or is it an era of where we're sort of growing up as a society and we're starting to recognize things in a more even, I suppose,
open-minded manner? That's an interesting question. I suppose part of the book looks, which I don't think's really been written about before, the way that digital technology has captured extremes of psychosis or mania. So there's that element of being watched, and you know, I write about a few instances of that. And then I guess there's a more general feeling of the culture as a whole being manic in itself, which is can be a bit of an iffy metaphor. You know, like it's used in describing markets and things like that. But you know, I guess we do feel like we're in a bit of a more ramped up time, and mental illness can be seen as being quite prevalent. But I think the other interesting thing is, I think people are more comfortable writing about it now, and that's sort of the other side of the book, is really looking at, and probably the strongest through line of the book is looking at how over 100 years, really, or just over 100 years since the term manic depression was first used, how people have come out in the culture, essentially, identifying with that term and finding their own voice within that. And I think, you know, in publishing over the last 10 years or so, there's been some really outstanding books in that realm, I guess.
And is it to do with the openness of social media and stuff like that that is allowing this? Because people are getting caught. Social media is in your hands, whether or not you're in a manic mood or not, and you write about that. And so we're seeing it. And so it's kind of getting outed by itself.
Yeah, there's a danger of that. I mean, the book opens with the case of Jason Russell, who founded the Kony 2012 video, which was a huge campaign in 2012, a social media campaign, and he ended up reaching a point of exhaustion and was photographed and videoed by a bystander. And he was naked and wailing in the street, and obviously at a really acute crisis point, in a kind of reactive psychotic episode. And so that was captured and then sold to TMZ, the famous kind of dirty, dirty publisher of, you know, salacious celebrity gossip, and that got spread that way. And so he had this very public mania. I think on the other side, you know, the benefit of things like social media is I think genuinely people are more comfortable talking about these things in public. And, I think some of the social media outlets have allowed people to, more naturally enter into a confessional mode.
Mm. You talk about, how there's dangers of people diagnosing others by looking at behaviour that you think might fit the case and making assumptions.
Yeah.
Is that getting worse, or do you think it's just...
I think in some instances, you know, like we've had a very interesting year with Kanye West, who I write about in the book, and there continues to be speculation, or there continued to be, and essentially released an album this year that had on the front that, you know, the word bipolar, which many people took to be a coming out of sorts. I think, you know, I mean, I make that point in the book because I do think it's dangerous, and I risk doing it myself in parts of the book. I think to project on anyone serious medical diagnostics is a bad idea.
But as part of it, the reaching for a mental role model, which is another thing you talk about in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I talk about a few role models in the book and sort of make a case for, you know, the kind of community of mental ill health needing leadership. But the people I write about in that aspect are self-identified. Yeah. So Carrie Fisher in particular, the actress and writer, was someone who talked about it for more than 20 years in her public life. And so I wanted to look at what that meant for her. You know, I tried my best to stay away from speculation.
Is there anybody that's not so much a celebrity that is a coming out with this angle at the moment in media?
In media, not. I think celebrities tend to take up the media space. Yeah. I suppose. You know, I guess I didn't go too much into public civilian life. I suppose just because I think you do risk speculation more. I mean, certainly something that I kind of shied away from. Perhaps could have looked at a little bit more is the state's kind of response to mental ill health and how that can kind of play into criminal activity. Yeah. Because there are a number of protections in terms of, you know, when someone exhibits mental ill health or psychosis or mania, you know, in terms of a legal framework, they can be protected. But I think the narrative of the book is essentially that kind of cultural history. And I think that needed to occur on a kind of public level, not kind of private instances. Although I use myself as a subject, and I don't think I'm a particularly public figure. So,
what was that like? Can we just hear a bit about you and where you came from and what you know where this book's come from?
Yeah, sure. So I was diagnosed with manic depression or bipolar, if you want to use that term. When I was 22, I pretty normal kid and just had some real troubles coming into adulthood. It is that age is 22 to 25 is the kind of key age when most diagnoses happen. It can happen at any time in your life, but that's kind of the key time. And I just exhibited all the classic symptoms, I guess. And, you know, I guess it's now 10 years of living with that diagnosis. So the book kind of hits an interesting anniversary in that sense. I guess, you know, I've written bits and pieces and had thoughts throughout the 10 years on where the diagnosis sits and how it plays, at large. And so this is collecting a lot of those thoughts into a condensed whole, I guess.
And 10 years is a long time in mental health. Like, yeah. The original diagnosis, is that does that stand for you, or are you been looking at it? And because, you know, there's a sliding scale on all these things.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Really that precise. And you want, do you want precision?
You do want precision because, you know, it often goes with medication, which needs to be incredibly precise. I've stuck to the same diagnosis over the 10 years. A lot of people do. You know, it takes time to find the right diagnosis. I guess I was lucky in that sense that the sticking diagnosis was there at the start. So that was luck for me. But, you know, it's something you constantly monitor. You want to be on top of it, definitely.
And this, because I know it seems bizarre, but there are certainly people out there who think that that mental health is a fashion.
Right.
And it's bizarre to think of that there are people out there that do that, but you know, it is difficult, like when people in your own family or people you love are sort of being diagnosed in different things, and half the family doesn't actually, like they're almost like Tom Cruise, they don't believe in existence. there is that fear, especially with celebrity. And with notoriety and people turning heads people that are being accused of faking it or wanting to have worse things than they've got, it seems absolutely nuts. But You see it on social media. People sort of going, "Oh, you're playing up to it for book sales, or you're trying to sell your new album."
Right. Yeah. I guess it just comes back to the speculation is really dangerous.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I've been lucky. I never encountered any skepticism on that level. And you know, I would feel tremendously sad for anyone who does.
Yeah. And in your own family life, was acceptance of the diagnosis, was it, because, you know, it can be quite rocky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. But it's, you know, I mean, I think the culture at the point that I was diagnosed, you know, the feeling was that it's a medical issue, you know, like yeah. It's just a medical issue like any other. And I think I was lucky that my family were in that frame of mind. I mean, part of the book towards the end of the book, I have a chapter on kind of family history on both sides. And that was not the case, you know, in their cases, which would have been, you know, 60 or 80 years ago. And it was hidden away and not talked about. But I think there's been a turn in the culture for good in that sense.
And when you talk about the difference between, you know, you can call it bipolar or you can call it mania, what is generally the way you think of you know, you're bipolar, you've got manic depression. Is it something that's just got a, you could already have a term for it? You just
go, yeah. I mean, in a clinical and medical sense, bipolar is the kind of fixed term at the moment because it's used in the, diagnostic manual. I have a little bit of a debate within the book about the term manic depression, which I kind of prefer. Just think it's got a kind of harder edge and you know, was the historical term. And, you know, I feel like bipolar is a bit of a straightening out in a sense. It flattens things out a little bit and, you know, perhaps makes it more accessible and marketable. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a little cheeky cultural argument to kind of stand up for the history of manic depression as a term and attempt to reclaim it, I guess.
Yeah. And what about the relationship between manic depression and writers and art and that line? Is there much in the, do you sort of delve into that?
Well, I guess in a way the whole book is that. I mean, you know, like it's very pop culture heavy. It looks at, you know, a number of notable figures throughout the kind of 20th century and early 21st century who dealt with it. You know, I kind of hesitated a little bit with that. I think there's a kind of overstretch of the bow with, you know, the link between creativity and manic depression can kind of, that song can get a bit tired.
Especially at times. If you don't have any creativity, you've got the
right. Yeah. Well, no, absolutely. Like, that's a really good point. And that certainly is an argument that exists. Jenny Diski, the great British writer, had a real point about, one of the writers I write about, Kay Redfield Jameson, wrote a whole book on the connections between manic depression and creativity, and Diski's review really did sort of like just, I guess, introduce the nuance that some people may not have any sense of creativity and yet still suffer this disorder. And so, you know, that is tricky, and it's a really good point to bring up.
Yeah, because it's a bummer, man. You could be a Virginia Woolf or suffer with absolutely no result.
Like, yeah.
With no creative output.
Yeah.
Like, what have you done to me?
On the other side of that, the statistics are kind of irrefutable and quite worrying, which is that I think it's something like 30% of writers are known to suffer manic depression, like the stat, or more likely to suffer manic depression. So it's the stats are a bit scary.
And do you make within the book, do you sort of talk about why you think that might be?
I feel like that topic was kind of covered, and I guess this is more a cultural history, and that would kind of, I think if you were really to get into that, it would have to be a kind of medicalized account. And certainly Kay Redfield Jameson, who's a terrific figure, had explored that in depth. Like she does have a whole book on the subject and comes from a background in psychiatry and psychology. So, you know, I feel like I defer to her in the book in that sense.
I'm interested in the last line of the book really struck me. And it's, I'm going to teach you to speak my language with this book.
Right, yeah.
That set me thinking a lot about the things you say in the book about the others, the supportive ones, the ones that you say are absent from the narrative because you don't want to speak for them. But they've been supportive and you acknowledge them in the acknowledgements. So there's the people who have the condition, the people who don't, who are trying to understand or failing to understand the others. I'm just interested in this idea about the language. What can people who are the others do?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like that's, you know, I mean, that line possibly directly is addressed to people who don't have a strong understanding or haven't had the same access to education or the kind of, you know, hooked into the same cultural kind of line that I was lucky that my family sort of were aware of or became learned through. And, you know, and maybe that's, you know, maybe that was their own self-learning because they were dealing with me at the kind of the height of my mania, I guess. And, you know, and some people might not have met someone with manic depression or have any kind of, like, life experience with that. So it's sort of, it's thinking about how other people react to these extremes of behavior that are a symptom of, you know, a disease essentially. So, I think, you know, if the book has a useful function and a culturally useful function, that would be my hope. And that's sort of the intention, with that. Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's any strategies that you got that people can bear in mind.
Writing a book and handing it to people, I guess, is sort of is the main strategy at the moment. I don't know. It is, you know, I mean, there's a moral ambiguity to the book that is exactly that part. There's a chapter called The Reckoning, which sort of deals with that aspect, which is, you know, essentially at the worst of, you know, the manic cycle, not the depressive cycle, it's like a hurricane going through a town. And so there's this kind of cleanup that's possibly necessary. But I feel like culturally we haven't quite figured out how to do that cleanup. And certainly I don't feel like I've quite mastered the cleanup or, you know, like I think that's kind of it felt like to me writing it that was the sort of last bastion of the formation of the public side of the disease. So it's like, it's just a bit of unexplored ground is like what happened, what is the reaction afterwards? You know, like you can sensationalize it, you can get upset yourself, but it's like, how do we figure out how to explain this to people who've been potentially wronged, you know, by someone in a manic episode? You know, it feels like it's the one thing that's sort of not fixed in my mind yet.
It's a wonderful, compelling experience to read this book and to see the vivid insight of an episode or how it feels. And there's some great bits in there where you say it doesn't feel like an illness. In fact, when I'm in the height of mania, I feel healthier and stronger and more self-assured than ever.
Right.
I always assumed from the outside that an episode would be rather a blur, like having a moment of extreme adrenaline. You come out of it and you go, oh, I can't remember exactly what happened in there.
Right.
But it's very clearly depicted from within in the sequences in the book. Is it... crystal clear in retrospect?
I mean, that's a great way to put it. I don't, you know, like, I don't know if that's a universal experience, but certainly for me, the heightened emotions and heightened, you know, sensitivities that go with a manic episode just do mean that it is crystal cut in a sense. You know, the memories are stronger than other memories I have, perhaps because of the heightened emotion. They just get, you know, carved in your mind a little bit stronger. I'm sure that's not the case for everyone, but in terms of me, it's, you know, those memories are kind of dangerous in a way because they're so, you know, it was such a pleasurable time. And I think that's part of the, you know, the moral question in the book is, you know, what is a disease that has as one of its symptoms, you know, pure pleasure? It's tricky. It's like, you know, I can't think of any other disorder or disease that would have that as a symptom. So it's like, yeah, it is the opposite of illness at times. It is, you know, strength and vitality and a pure love of life that tips over into a kind of dangerous end of the spectrum. I guess the retribution for that is the depressive side of it. Yeah. So it's like, that's the balance.
Is it, saying, like when you were talking before about the tornado going through there, and, you know, the people that are hurt or feel aggrieved at the other end, because of the pleasure side of it, because of the memories are so pleasurable at the time, you know, obviously not having too much of a concern about the other person.
Right.
Are you, in retrospect, able to see that that was a wrong thing to have done at that particular time, or is it, does it still feel so right?
No, it doesn't. You know, I mean, I guess it doesn't. It's, I think if you have a kind of moral complexity to your person, you can see that you've done the wrong thing in those situations. And certainly, you know, it's a slow learning process. And the problem for a lot of people, I think, is that the manic episode is quickly followed by a depressive crash, which doesn't allow for much insight or self-reflection. And if it does, it's quite painful. So I think that, you know, I guess it is, again, that muddy area of the kind of cleanup, you know, like, you know, what does an apology look like in that sense? You know, like, I was out of control. I was suffering from something within. You know, it is really, that side of it is incredibly ambiguous.
Mm. Yeah.
I was interested by the different kinds of triggers as well.
Mm.
So whether it be watching a particularly amazing tennis match on TV and suddenly deciding, I have to go to Melbourne. I have to see this.
Yeah.
And getting in the car and doing that.
Yeah.
Although not getting to the tennis match.
No. Getting back in the car.
But the triggers could be that, or empathy for a friend in the pub talking about their experiences and things like that, leading to events. These are things that, to my mind, I would never have dreamed of as being triggers.
Mm.
Is that...
I don't think there's so much triggers. I think those are symptoms. You know, the tennis match was the first episode I ever went through, and I had never had any interest in tennis, and yet suddenly I was up at all hours watching, you know, repeats of the Australian Open, you know, early in the morning, and pacing back and forth, and, you know, I was living just south of Newcastle and decided to get in a car and drive to Melbourne to go to a match, and, you know, just ended up not having any money and, you know, lolling about and staying in a hostel without booking a room. And, you know, I mean, that's the episode. I don't, you know, that's not necessarily the trigger. The trigger would be, you know, the disorder itself and then possibly some environmental stress or elements like that.
I just focused on the tennis.
Yeah,
The tennis fell into your...
No, totally. Yeah. I think I write in the book that, you know, that the thwack of the ball was the only thing that was calming my mind at the time. It was sort of like providing a little metronome, I guess, within my head.
Sam, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It's been very interesting. And there's so many different ways we can sort of approach this. I haven't read the book, and I certainly want to read this book. Rob's been talking about it. He's had the copy, and he's been going on about the book. So... congratulations.
Thanks.
We hope that just as you spoke earlier in the podcast, that this is your explanation. You hand it out to people and say, this is...
It's my new business card.
these are the words you need to know.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Certainly a significant contribution.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And you can get hold of a copy of The Rapids, booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.